let's go ahead and get started, and let's start by having you introduce yourself. I mean, just tell us you're here.
I'm Hayward in Tucson.
Hey. Next.
Kathleen in Sonoma.
Bridget in Berkeley. Tracy in Berkeley. Yeah. This is Karin in Germany.
Yeah.
Nanka in Holland.
Oh, hi, Nanka. And who else just joined us?
David F.
Morning. Hi. Good morning, David. And who else?
David M.
Okay, great. Our Davids. And anybody else who hasn't checked in yet? We got everybody? Okay. So, let's see. So this week we were working with Love of Knowledge. Hi, who's that?
Good morning, Robert here.
Hi, Robert. So this week we were working with Love of Knowledge, and for this week's reading and next week's reading, we're kind of taking a step back to try to understand about stories from a different perspective. At least that's how I think about the connection between this reading and what we've been doing so far. So, you know, in Dynamics, we went pretty quickly from thoughts to stories because that's the way it's laid out in Dynamics, is making that connection. And in Love of Knowledge, there's this kind of in-between. That's not quite the right way, but there's, just talk about it, but there's kind of an in-between step between thoughts and stories, and that's models. And I think looking at models, and then next week we'll be looking at the more general structure of interpretation, it helps us understand how stories function. But models are not exactly stories. I think I suggested in the guidance, models are a kind of subset of stories. That is, there's lots of different kinds of stories, and some of them are models. But, you know, we don't have to insist too much on the distinction. I'm just trying to give you a sense of how it seems to me these things fit together. So, in the reading, I thought it would be a good idea. Hi, who's that?
This is Bruce.
Hi, Bruce. So, I thought it would be a good idea to start with descriptive knowledge. As I said in the guidance, the very first few statements in the chapter that we're reading start by referencing descriptive knowledge, and that's a term that's introduced earlier on in Love of Knowledge, in page 104, just a few pages earlier, but it wasn't in our reading. So if you go back and look at what's said about descriptive knowledge on 104, it's presented very much in terms of turning toward the past. And the basic idea here, and in the context of Love of Knowledge, it has a specific significance, but that doesn't have to concern us too much. The basic idea is that we have a way of knowing, which Rinpoche here calls descriptive knowledge, which is based on looking back, and the exact sentence on 104 is, descriptive knowledge draws on the past to bring essential coherence and order to direct experience. I'm going to leave off the reference to polar knowledge. So here we are, we're having direct experience. And what direct experience means is something we've already looked at a little bit, you know, and I think that's interesting, but we don't need to look at it right now. So descriptive knowledge looks at the past. Basically, it's the way things were. And on the basis of the way things were, it describes, or we use it to describe to ourselves the way things are. So we're always trying to make our present experience match up with our past experience. And we do that by describing what's happening to us. And part of what's interesting in that is, at the moment we describe something to ourselves, we are already making it past experience instead of present experience. You know, first there's the experience, and then in the next moment there's the experience of describing that experience, which means that when we're describing, we have to be looking backwards at what's already happened. So the moment we work with descriptive knowledge, the moment we look at the past, we can no longer be in contact with immediate present experience. So what happens with descriptive knowledge, or by looking at this idea of descriptive knowledge and the way that it draws on the past, I think that already shows us something very interesting about stories. Because a story is founded on that kind of description. You know, in a story, we either tell ourselves or enter into an understanding, a way of making sense out of what's going on, that is based on what's already happened. It's based on our having made sense out of what's already happened. Or that's not really quite the right way to say it. It's based on our looking back and making sense out of what's happened.
The memory of a previous experience.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. But it's not necessarily a memory in the sense that something that happened yesterday. It could also very much be the memory of what just happened, but in the specific sense that we take what just happened and fit it in to our understanding of what's possible to happen. And this gets discussed in the reading. You know, we have to make immediate experience fit in with our models, our constructs, our stories. And so here I'm just lumping together models and stories. And in doing that, as Rinpoche says, we lose something. We lose the immediacy of experience. So there's a discussion of that on page 105. So I'm still looking at the part that wasn't assigned about descriptive knowledge. And Rinpoche uses this interesting example, and I say interesting example because it's one of these examples that he uses that, at least for me, once I read it, it just stayed with me. And so it's available to kind of help understand your own experience. He uses the example of the moon reflected in the waters of a river. So, of course, looking at the moon in the water, it has a ripply quality. It's a ripply moon. It's moving along with the waves. But what he says about that then is if the eye sees the moon reflected in the waters of a river, the present experience is the continuously changing flow of water, illuminated by the light of the moon. Descriptive knowing, however, leads the self to identify the content of the experience, naming it the reflection of the moon. So, I think the idea is clear enough. The question is, what's the experiential impact of that? We go through the world and we are always naming and labeling, and we've been talking about that for weeks. And so this discussion of descriptive knowledge is related to that idea that we're always naming and labeling. And what he's pointing out is that because that's what we do, something of the immediacy of experience is lost. In my experience in working with TSK, or for that matter meditation, people generally have a sense of that, you know, one of the reasons people are interested in meditating is that there is we all have this sense, this experience that sometimes the world seems very fresh and alive, but mostly it seems more stale, more flat, kind of dead almost. And in meditation, we can recover that quality of aliveness, and it seems like that's more real, more true to who we are. And with TSK practice too, you know, there are ways of connecting up to the immediacy of presence that really make a difference. So I'm assuming that people understand and agree with this idea that the labeling process, descriptive knowledge, the models that we put into place are all ways of distancing ourselves, or they all have the effect of distancing ourselves from experience. Does anybody want to comment on that? Say anything about it?
One thing that...
Yeah. Go ahead.
For me, it's just something I've been reflecting on lately, reading, you know, a number of postmodern writers who are denying that there is anything like an immediacy of experience,
mm-hmm.
that it's always mediated.
Right.
And experientially, I know that freshness that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I relate to it on that level, but I've admittedly entered a kind of zone of epistemological confusion over the postmodern arguments that basically everything is always at a distance.
Okay, well, that's a really big topic. But we've actually already been talking about it in a number of ways. And let me comment on it just a little bit, and then I'm sure we'll come back to it as we go on. It relates exactly to this idea of developing models. So I'm going to jump ahead, or I'm going to change the flow of what I wanted to do here a little to point to that, because it's a good way of talking about the difference between models and stories and experience. There are strong philosophical movements which talk about the fact that experience is always mediated. A specific example, which is a little different from that, but it's one that I think is useful because of the direction we're going to be going in, is there are a lot of modern philosophers who talk about the self and say, well, obviously the self doesn't exist. The self is a construct. And they make this kind of argument, you know, where they say, we're always pulling together experience in certain ways. We're always reflecting on it. And that's the only contact we have with experience. And the self is a construct that we use to make sense out of experience. That sounds a lot like what Rinpoche is saying here. And it is a lot like what Rinpoche is saying here. The important difference is that way of philosophizing is very much on the level of models and constructs. You build up a model of the way reality is. And let's say your model says we can never have contact with the immediacy of experience. That doesn't tell you anything about what your experience is like, because models are always on this level of explanation and description. So when you're looking back at your experience and you say, oh, it's just a story I've made up and I can never have contact with experience, that's not the reality of your situation, or situation isn't a good word. That's not how things can be. You know, there is this distinction that we all know and we're all aware of between an experience that's fresh and immediate and an experience that is a reflection in the kind of literal sense. It's just, you know, it's like something bounces off something else and is reflected. And we don't really have contact with the original experience, just with the reflection of the experience. And philosophical thought is all about that. It's all about models that we make of experience. So if you say, if your model is that the self doesn't exist, it doesn't change the way you live your life. You know, you sort of, there's a very famous passage by a 18th century Western philosopher named Hume, where he's talking about the existence of a self. And he talks about it in what sound like very Buddhist terms, and he says, you know, I can't really ever find a self when I look. All I find is a bundle of perceptions. I think that's the term he uses. And he says, that's very confusing. That's very puzzling to me. It seems as though the self doesn't exist. And then he says in this passage, he says, well, I don't remember the exact words, but in effect he says, you know, I've thought about this enough now. I think I'm going to go off and play pool, billiards. And you know, that I've always loved that passage because, even though I'm not quoting it exactly correctly, because that's exactly what philosophy does. It, you know, it comes up with this kind of elegant theoretical analysis, or in our terms, it comes up with a model. And then you go about living your life. You know, you prove to yourself that the self doesn't exist, but then you spend the rest of your life acting as though you were completely convinced that the self does exist. And it's exactly because what you've done is you've taken the possibility of knowledge and kind of filtered it through this structure where knowledge is something that's based on a model. You know, so as Rinpoche says, and this is a very important point, our model of knowledge is that knowledge comes through models. So we have kind of a model for knowledge. It sounds a little abstract to say it that way and theoretical. But the point here is that as long as that's the way we're using our intelligence to construct models, then we're making a break. We're losing the possibility that our ability to ask questions, our capacity to inquire, could really transform our experience, because we've turned the whole inquiry process into something that's mediated through models, that's based on models, and we lose it. You know, we lose the significance. And that's one reason why I thought it would be appropriate to do exercise 9, the dynamics exercise, for this week, because that exercise is set up in such a way that it's meant to counter that movement, because you start with space and you start with how you are in the immediacy of your experience, which is what space is all about. Space is about the immediacy of our experience. You start with that and you try to develop an appreciation or a sense of that. And when you do, then whatever insights you then later have about thoughts, because that comes later in the exercise, they have an effect on your life. They're not just a model. They're not, you know, we all have this experience, I think, of having some kind of an insight, and then very quickly the insight fades. Karen was talking about this a little last week. You know, you see something, and for a little while it really changes your experience, and then it's gone. You know, the aliveness of the insight is gone. And what's happened really is that the immediate insight, which transforms the space that you inhabit, is turned into a model for what experience is. And then from there it can become a story, you know, that you use to explain. But it's still, I think, talking in terms of models is a little more helpful here. So when you're talking about postmodern philosophers, you know, I don't want to say more about that right now, and I'm not sure I really want to talk in terms of postmodern philosophy, because, you know, for most people that's not so interesting. But that the conclusion that they draw when they say, oh, all experience is mediated, all experience is a pale reflection of experience, and in fact there's nothing but our reflections, our models, our stories, all of that is true. But it has no consequences for philosophy, for the philosopher, but it does have consequences if we approach it from within our experience or from within the possibility of a space that is not a modeled space. And then you kind of, you know, you immediately tie yourself in knots, because you say, well, but wait a minute, there can't be such a thing as a space without models. You know, Rinpoche talks about zeroless space, and if some postmodern philosopher looked at that, they might say, well, no, you know, you can only ever have space that is zero, because zero less, you can't get to that. You can't get to immediacy. But that's because we don't understand, or they don't understand, immediacy. It's because they think that knowledge has to depend on models. Okay, well, that was a long mini lecture, but let me stop there. But if people have any comments on that, Bruce, did you want to tie that in.
No, I appreciated that. That was helpful for me, and it put me in mind of a passage in Visions of Knowledge, where he talks about there's a difference between, you know, saying that our reality depends on constructs, and then actually entering into realizing that constructiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's paraphrase. I can't remember exactly how he put it.
Well, that's good, and I think that you know, a fundamental way of talking about this would be to say that it's a little bit like, you know, the one line that everybody knows in Western philosophy, I suppose, is Descartes saying, "I think, therefore I am," right? And you can criticize that in a lot of different ways, but what you can say is that whatever conclusions you may draw, there is the activity of drawing a conclusion. You know, there is some kind of experiential level. Something is happening, and there is a kind of an awareness at work. And when we can contact that awareness, then whatever else we have to say about content is no longer so interesting. And that's kind of where we're headed. I wanted to give a specific example from my own experience. It's kind of like this moon and water experience, but I thought it might be helpful, and it was interesting to me at the time. And it just had let me just tell you the story. This was a couple of years ago up at the Ratnaling Retreat Center, speaking of which I assume you all know now or have been reminded about the retreat that's happening at Ratnaling. So anyway, this was at the Retreat Center, and it was at one of the conferences that Center for Creative Inquiry organizes in consciousness. And I guess it was just last year, actually. And one of the people who was participating in this conference was an artist, a woman who works with especially the sense of touch and how it relates to awareness. I think that was her main focus. So she had us do an exercise in this consciousness conference where we closed our eyes and we let somebody else lead us around. So we were just being guided, and there was a certain quality of trust involved. And then her instructions were that the person who was leading the other person should lead them up to something they wanted them to see. And then the person whose eyes were closed should open their eyes for just a moment, just a second, and register what they saw, and then close their eyes. And we did that three times, I think, and then we came back and had talked about our experiences. So, of course, let me just give you the experience first, and then I'll comment on it. So one of the three times that I did this, the person who was leading me led me up to a window. And the window looked out on some trees and an area where there were a couple of cars parked and some grass. It was kind of an outdoor scene. And it was kind of late in the evening, so it was getting a little dark. But you could certainly still see. And when I opened my eyes for just that brief second, what the person who was leading me expected was that I would see the trees and the grass and that scene outside, and, you know, was curious what my reaction would be. But when I opened my eyes, what I actually saw was the window. I didn't see anything else, but, well, it's not true. I saw something else. But what I mostly saw was the window and the screen. There was a mosquito netting, a screen to keep out the insects. So I saw the window and the screen, and then kind of vaguely in the back, I saw that there were trees and things. And I found that very interesting, reflecting on it afterwards, because exactly what had happened was that I didn't have any past. You know, I saw that scene with not just with no expectation, but with no background, nothing prepared me for it, because it was out of context. There was no context. I had my eyes closed and I was led somewhere and I didn't know what I was going to see. So I had no expectation. And having no expectation, when I opened my eyes in that moment, I wasn't relying on the past to construct a story. And so what I saw in the immediacy of that experience was the window on the screen. Now, you could say there was still a story involved because immediately I recognized the window as a window. I recognized the screen as a screen. I knew where I was. I had my sense of myself. All of that was going on. But in terms of our usual expectations, when you look out a window, what you expect to see is the scene outside the window. You don't expect to see the window. It's kind of like looking through glasses, you know. If you're wearing glasses, you don't pay any attention to the glasses, although they're always there within the field of your vision, but that's not what you're expecting to look at. So we have this model about what's going to count as real, but our immediate experience is something very different from that. That example, as I say, it's a lot like the example of the moon in the water, but it had a kind of a power for me, at least, and I hope I was able to convey some of that. Anything people want to say at this point? Any descriptions you would like to share? Any experience you would like to share?
Yeah, I have one. A little while back, I was walking with a friend in San Francisco, and I happened to look up. I saw motion in my eye. I happened to look up there at a window, and I saw what seemed like a cloth of some kind moving back and forth rhythmically. And I immediately went into trying to figure out what it was. And I could see that I was going, to pass these things that I have experienced before. Like maybe it's just a curtain waving and with a fan that's going automatically. But then I would rule out all of those possibilities. No, it can't be that because blah, blah, blah. And eventually, I noticed that I was trying to figure it out based on stories or models or information that I had from the past, and none of them worked because it still didn't seem to be what it was. And I kind of had to accept that I don't know what it is, and just hang out with that. Oh, this is cool, not knowing what it is.
Right.
Although it was a little hard to accept because then I immediately went into stories saying I should be able to figure out what it is.
Right. Right.
Mm. So anyway, that's what I.
Yeah. That reminds me of something I've noticed sometimes. If you're out walking in nature, I've had this experience a few times. I'm out for a walk, and I see some very bright color off in the distance, and I look and I say, oh, a beautiful flower, and I have a certain reaction. And then when I get a little closer, I see that it's actually a piece of plastic that somebody's discarded, And of course, my whole reaction changes. I say, litter in the landscape. But it was the same experience. It was the same beautiful burst of color in the middle of nature. So everything else is just, my story, my description of what's going on, and then my reaction to my own description. That's very much the way it works. Let's see. I'm skipping around here a little bit. One of the things I suggested in the guidance essay was that you could try substituting the word story for model in this chapter. Did people try that? Anybody notice anything in doing that or find it interesting?
No? I had difficulty finding a time when it didn't work. So
okay. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know. There were times where it was of course they're the same, and then there were times where it didn't quite seem the same. But then it was a story. It was, and I was unable to discern the difference between the two different ways.
I want to take one specific example, and then maybe comment on it, and I think that's probably about all we have time for, almost all. On page 130 at the bottom, there's a couple of sentences, or this paragraph I thought we could do that with. So it's the paragraph that starts, such models, and he's talking about the models that we don't question. There's some models we question, and it's kind of built into the model that it's questionable. But some models we don't question at all, such as the model that there's a self that knows a world. And that would be fun to talk about, but we don't have time. So then he says, such models are so familiar to us that we may never reflect on them explicitly or notice them in operation. So just very quickly, to substitute stories, he says, let's imagine doing that. Let's try doing it. It says, such stories, the stories that we tell, are so familiar to us that we may never reflect on them explicitly or notice them in operation. And because each story supports and draws support from countless others, a structure is created that is far too complex to be examined as a whole. As a result, we lose sight of the difficulties and contradictions that interacting stories generate, and simply accept the knowledge such stories provide as the way things are. Now, I think you can see that it makes perfectly good sense to use the word story, except maybe the very last example, or the very last use, where he says, we lose sight of the difficulties and contradictions that interacting stories generate, and simply accept the knowledge such stories provide. That's the one place where I think it's perhaps the most clear what the difference is between a model and a story. Models tend to have to do with providing knowledge. And stories, although they do provide knowledge, because they're the way we make sense out of things, that's not what they're mostly about. Stories are mostly about the way things are. So there's a knowledge component. But, you know, stories always have this potential, or at least a lot of stories do, that we can inhabit the story. And that the movie, we didn't, you know, the, for last week, Stranger Than Fiction is a nice meditation on that question. But, you know, you inhabit a story. You can live within it. Models are not like that. Models are meant to explain or to describe, and you're not meant to inhabit them. Which goes back to this point about, you know, theories in philosophy or models about what's really real or, you know, what's mediated and what's immediate. All of that is just on the level of trying to explain what's real. And it doesn't matter very much, whereas in terms of our experience. Whereas stories, the most important kind of story anyway, is exactly about making clear to us what our experience is, giving us our experience, sort of interpreting our experience for ourselves. Right? And so, you know, it works fine in this paragraph to substitute stories, but I think if you think about the knowledge component, you'll see kind of what the difference is, or get a better sense of what the difference is between stories and models. And I have one example in mind that maybe will help clarify that also. I live, as some of you know, I live in this in a community here within the Nyingma community, and there are a couple of little kids who live here whom I don't actually see very much, but there's a little girl named Lamo, and Lamo is I think 5 or 6 years old, and she started school this year. And so this year she was learning what Valentine's Day is. And I think Valentine's Day is, you have that in Germany too, right?
Not so much.
It's you know, Valentine's
Day. Only the heart, but not the meaning.
Okay. Well, the basic idea, you know, is you're supposed to show how much you care about the people around you. Originally, very much a romantic sense. It was, you know, your lover. You know, Valentine's Day was for lovers. I think there's actually a saying or something like that. But nowadays, it's just supposed to show that you care for people. And one of the things they do in school in America is everybody gives Valentine's to everybody. You know, they give little cards or something. So Lamo gave cards to everybody in the house. Or actually, she gave a little candy and a card to everybody. well, that doesn't matter too much, but it started me thinking, she's being trained in a story. You know, she has to be, it's not as though she was born with an understanding of what Valentine's Day is. That's an obvious thing. But, you know, the teacher stood up in front of the class and said, okay, we're going to celebrate Valentine's Day. Let me explain to you what Valentine's Day is. But having explained it, you could say that's kind of on the model level. She says, so, in effect, she was saying, so now, this is how you're supposed to live your life if you're a part of this culture. You know? Part of the ongoing story that everybody shares and everybody agrees on is that February 14th every year is a special day in which you show people that you like them and care about them and that you're friends with them. And that's what you're supposed to do. So you start off with an explanation, or a model may not work so well there, and you end up with a story which you're supposed to take into your story. And that's actually an awful lot of what education is about. One part of education is about giving you the models which will help you explain and make sense of things and kind of lead in the direction of scientific knowledge, you could say. But the other part of education is training you, sometimes people say socializing you, in the stories that everybody shares and agrees on. So that may, again, may help make the distinction. We're running a little late. Let me just look at the last paragraph of the reading, which again is about models, and let's again substitute stories. There's actually only a couple of places. So I'm just going to read it with the word story instead of the word model. In each story, there is a place that remains impenetrable. The limited knowledge allowed within the story is positioned in a specific way. For example, as wisdom, rationality, faith, etc. A line is established beyond which knowledge cannot go. So here again, that's a good paragraph to reflect on because it's talking about the relationship between models and knowledge. And if you start to talk about the relationship between stories and knowledge, it becomes a broader concept. So, I mean, the knowledge part of it becomes a broader context. Because what you're doing is you're looking more toward the story that tells you what's real. Not just the story that explains, but the story which makes sense out of your whole reality. And so for next week, when we're going to be reading the next chapter, it introduces another word that's related to stories and models, and that's the word interpretation. And interpretation is an even broader word because it encompasses both of those. It encompasses the kind of knowledge we get through models, which is more theoretical and abstract, and it encompasses the kind of knowledge we get through stories, which very much shapes our experience. Okay, well, we didn't talk about your experience with Exercise 9, but I would encourage you to find some time during the week to practice with that a little bit and look at this, look at the way in which the space dimension contributes to an awareness of thoughts and stories, and maybe especially with this sense in mind of the difference between the knowledge that comes out of models and concepts and the knowledge that is shaping our reality. Because that's where we're going. We're after this chapter, we're going to be talking about, in Love of Knowledge, we're going back to stories, and we're going then taking that in the direction of the self, which is where we've been heading all along, the story of the self, which is not just a model for experience, but a story that really constitutes the foundation for all of our experience, the story of the self. Okay, so I will post a little essay orienting you toward next week. Any closing questions or comments? Anything that was confusing. There's always a lot of content that comes across from these phone calls, and I hope that's useful, but I hope, you know, it might be a little confusing.
Yeah, that's definitely useful.
Okay, well, thanks. But is there anything that desperately needs to be clarified before we sign off? No. I've numbed them. Okay, well, if there are questions that come up, by all means, write a post, and I will try. You know, this last week I was on retreat, so I couldn't really look at things too much, but I will try. I should be able in this next week to respond to questions or comment on posts that people make.